Today, in honor of Black History Month, we're pulling from the archives of New Letters on the Air. Broadcasting writers since 1977, we've been chosen for a Save America's Treasures grant, but we need help from listeners. Visit our website, newletters.org/radio, and click on Imperiled Voices. Now on with the show. A certain type of life is plot-driven, a certain slant in life. Those are words from Plot, the third book of poetry by Claudia Rankine. Known for her genre-bending work that melds poetry and essay with images on the page and now on the screen, Claudia Rankine's creative psyche was undoubtedly shaped by her background, though she is rarely confessional in her work. Born in Jamaica in the 60s, she grew up in the Bronx.
So there was a real sense already of a disconnect with the American landscape. And I remember my mother saying things like, "You don't know about the white people here and how they treated the black people." And that's something that she had learned coming here. So she would pass that information on to her children. You know, you have to be careful.
Claudia Rankine discusses Don't Let Me Be Lonely, her fourth collection that Robert Creeley describes as the most articulate and moving testament to the bleak times we live in. Stay with us for this edition of New Letters on the Air, a production of the University of Missouri, Kansas City. I'm Angela Elam, and here's New Letters magazine editor Robert Stewart, who talked with Claudia Rankine about her two most recent books while they were at the 2008 Associated Writing Programs Conference in New York City.
Plot, I thought, was really a fascinating, beautiful book, really about a woman who's pregnant through the whole thing. And you said that you could not have written that book had you had a child at the time. I believe you said something to that effect.
I do remember saying that. And I still believe that's true. I think now that I'm a mother, I don't think I would have allowed myself to plummet in the way that the protagonist in Plot does, plummet in areas of self-doubt, and to give herself the license to be able to say to a child, "You should go back from this world." I couldn't say that now. I really couldn't, because yeah. I don't know why. I could say other things, but I couldn't say that. So I do think that Plot was written from the point of view of somebody considering having a child and envisioning the 9 months through that pregnancy. But I don't think that I could go to that place. Talking about Plot, I feel so far from it now. It's been a few years. But I was reading a lot of Virginia Woolf, and she didn't have children. She had a lot of anxiety around not having children. And she was a source of some of the anxiety that's actually in the text.
Yeah, it's something of a harrowing book, and yet I think ultimately an optimistic book, at least the way I read it. I tend to look for the optimism anyway, so maybe I was.
It's there. I think in the end, if the child is born, the optimism is born as well.
Yeah, exactly. And we are going to get talking about your more recent work too, but one little stylistic device that you seem to use in Plot that represents a little bit of a lot of things that you do in your writing: you stop your sentences just before the sentence really completes itself, and then start the next sentence with the word you would have expected before the period. If I can just give you an example of that from Plot: "For it is he who yawns, the body distended, he who turns toward," period. Next sentence, "light of each burning bulb." I don't know if you were conscious of that, or are you?
I'm always interested in ways to open up the text. And Plot had to do with engendering and having things come out of other things. And so I think when I was working on that book, it would make sense that the next thing, whatever it is, the next sentence, the next thought, the next utterance, would be something that came even prematurely out of the thing before it, you know? So though I can't say for sure, yes, I remember, the larger process was that.
At one point you said that you'd had a rather harrowing childhood yourself, that as a writer and as a poet, that you didn't want to get stuck in just recalling and reliving those events in your poems. Am I reading that comment correctly?
Exactly. My feeling is that there is a way of approaching writing that steps out of the lived experience. And the lived experience is complicated, and we view ourselves in certain ways. And I think in terms of what happened in our own childhoods. And so I think that sometimes it doesn't allow enough movement because it's necessary for the writer to feel cared for, to feel understood in ways that are necessary to their self-being or their sense of self. And so I tend to not want to use writing in that way. I mean, Lowell obviously found it useful to go back in and look at his upbringing, and life studies comes out of that kind of investigation. And a lot has been written in the confessional mode since then. For me, I just don't find it as much of a generative process, you know? Mm-hmm. So, because I'm always there, I feel like I'm always present in my work. Or it's necessary for me to see how it is that I overlap with the next person. And if I stay purely autobiographical, then the overlap disappears.
Well, so much of your work, it's a combination of socially connected ideas and images and very personal, intimate mm-hmm. connection of images, especially in Don't Let Me Be Lonely. Yeah, I thought it was such a beautiful title for the book because the book is all about connectedness, I think.
The title, I will say that the title came because I was reading the letters of Paul Celan the year that he died and the year that he committed suicide. And he signed one of the last letters, "You're Very Lonely, Paul Celan." And I thought, you don't want to have to give up on this world. Especially, we were in a time when people were saying, I'm going to move to Canada if Bush is elected. I'm going to leave this country. And, you know, I thought, no. What you need to do is recognize that there are others in the same position who also believe that what's going on is not a good thing.
That's right. To me, it was such an uplifting book because it's all about people needing people. I wonder if you would mind reading from it.
Oh, not at all. At the airport security checkpoint, on the way to visit my grandmother, I am asked to drink from my water bottle. This water bottle? That's right. Open it and drink from it. At the airport security checkpoint, on the way to visit my grandmother, I am asked to take off my shoes. Take off my shoes? Yes, both please. My grandmother is in a nursing home. It's not bad. It doesn't smell like pee. It doesn't smell like anything. When I go to see her, as I walk through the hall past the common room in the nurse's station, old person after old person puts out his or her hand to me. Stephen, one says. Anne, another calls. It's like being in a third world country, but instead of food or money, you are what is wanted, your company. In third world countries, I have felt overwhelmingly American, calcium rich, privileged, and white. Here, I feel young, lucky, and sad. Sad is one of those words that has given up its life for our country. It's been a martyr for the American dream. It's been neutralized, co-opted by our culture to suggest a tinge of discomfort that lasts the time it takes for this and then for that to happen. The time it takes to change a channel. But sadness is real because once it meant something real. It meant dignified, grave. It meant trustworthy. It meant exceptionally bad, deplorable, shameful. It meant massive, weighty, forming a compact body. It meant falling heavily. And it meant of a color, dark. It meant dark in color, to darken. It meant me. I felt sad.
That was Claudia Rankine reading from her book, Don't Let Me Be Lonely, and on New Letters on the Air. There was a tragedy in the middle of the book of a woman, I believe a relative, maybe a sister, whose children and husband were killed.
Yeah, I should say right now that nothing in this book happened to me personally. People want to know, is it fiction? Is it nonfiction? Is it true to you? What I think is an honest answer is it's true to somebody. Everything in the book is true to somebody, and it's been overheard by me. And that the use of the first person in the book becomes a kind of collective eye that moves through situations that have touched the lives of people that I have known. But it's not my life.
Okay.
That's
I'm glad to hear that in this particular case. Yeah. It's funny because I was talking to some younger poets, and I said, look, poetry is fiction. Poetry is not meant to be journalism or autobiography in its basic core. They did not like hearing that. They want it to be true in some fairly graspable, literal way.
And the book is incredibly true in terms of the way in which I feel about the world. And in order to get to that place, you know, in order to get to a moment where I can say, my sense of the world is that the I needs the you, the I needs to recognize the you, that we need to recognize each other. How I get there, I will get there through as many bodies as I can, because I want to recognize those bodies. I want to accommodate as many lives as I possibly can.
There's a section in there. Is that Mr. Toole's section in that, or is it in Plot?
It's in Don't Let Me Be Lonely, because as I was working on Don't Let Me Be Lonely, I really tracked all the news in all the newspapers and on the radio and on the BBC and NPR and everywhere else. And so other stories would come up that seemed relevant to this notion of looking at the state of the American soul. And the story of Mr. Toole's, it was in the newspaper, and I just was fascinated because he received the first artificial heart, and his name was Mr. Toole's. And I just found that the irony in that incredible. And to add to that, he was also a black man, so they didn't want to tell you for fear that if it didn't work, people would think they were experimenting on black people. And so it was, you know, it had so many layers that...
You know, that's such a beautiful little section. I just love that section. Mm-hmm. And it's not very long. I wonder if you would read that for
course,
us as well.
Mr. Toole's, for a while the only person in the world walking around with an artificial heart, said the weirdest thing was being without a heartbeat. His was a private and perhaps lonely singularity. No one else could say, I know how you feel. The only living being without a heartbeat, he had a whir instead. It was not the same whir of a siren, but rather the fast, repetitive whir of a machine whose insistent motion might eventually seem like silence. Mr. Toole's had the ultimate tool in his body. He felt its heaviness. The weight on his heart was his heart. All his apparatus, artificial heart, energy coil, battery, and controller, weighed more than 4 pounds. The whir, if you are not Mr. Toole's, is detectable only with a stethoscope. For Mr. Toole's, that whir was his sign that he was alive.
Claudia Rankine, reading from Don't Let Me Be Lonely. This is Robert Stewart, and the whole book really is a question. Why am I alive? Going up and down the hills of some kind of landscape, searching for some kind of an answer to that question. And let me ask you about the notes in the back. That's not terribly unusual for poets, especially in the last decade or so. It seems like a lot of poets are putting notes in the back of books. But yours are really extensive in the back. Was that part of the fun of it, or was it part of trying to achieve some level of credibility beyond what?
I don't think it was credibility. It was anxiety. Because one of the things that I began to worry about with the book was this question of the I and whether or not people would believe that that I was a personal I. So then I thought, what things can I do to the book to posit its truth value in another place? So I thought, well, if I put these notes that attest to facts, then people won't believe the facts exist in the actual text. And so that was the rationale behind it, that if I move the literal truth value into the notes, it wouldn't then be in the text, so that the reading of the text would be seen as some other kind of enterprise, not one of communicating information.
It is different in a way from what we call nonfiction or essay writing, in the sense that a poem wants to just get the facts out of the way so we can get to the poem part.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I forget who said this, but I love the quote that poetry is a soul inaugurating a form. That notion that I wanted in the text a soul to rise up, that the meeting of one soul with another, which sounds so corny, but I did want that. I wanted the text to be able to say, look, you know, look at me and I will look at you. And that's all I wanted it to say. I was trying to strip away because there are things in the text that are not right. For instance, there's a section about the Nazi camps, and in the story in the text, the numbering has to do with whether it's alphabetical or whether it's, I can't even remember now, but the actual fact of how the prisoners were numbered, the Jews were numbered, the fact of it is in the notes. What's in the text is incorrect, even though the text presents it as correct.
As correct, yes. Well, so much of your work, especially in Don't Let Me Be Lonely and in some of the new work that you're doing, which is more, you're moving more into video production, the images and the effects and the activities of the culture is getting in a very direct way into your writing, especially in Don't Let Me Be Lonely. You have images. James Beard's story is horrifying. Basically, he was a black man who accepted a ride from some drunken fellows. Where was that?
In Jasper, Texas.
And they put a chain around his body and dragged him for about 3 miles.
Mm-hmm.
What year did that take place in?
Well, this is where the notes become useful. June 7, 1998. Three men, John King, Lawrence Hoover, and Sean Berry, offered James Beard Jr. a ride home in Berry's pickup truck. And then they sped along the road just east of town. Beard's shredded torso was found first, and then his head, neck, and right arm were found about a mile away. Police said a trail of blood, body parts, and personal effects stretched for 2 miles.
Yes, and you've managed to integrate those things both verbally and visually into Don't Let Me Be Lonely, which is a kind of an experimental form of writing in which you're kind of shaping your own form in that book. So maybe you could talk a little bit about how this developed in your writing.
The Don't Let Me Be Lonely is an interesting book to me because I didn't know what it would look like when I started working on it. I was in Europe. I think I was actually in France. I remember the day because I had just gone to the Pompidou Museum and I was walking home, and the debates were on in the United States, and I was so outraged by Bush's sort of casual reference to James Beard's death that I just started writing on napkins as I passed cafes as a response, almost as if I thought I was going to write a letter to the New York Times. And I just started writing things down. And it was then that I decided that I would begin to track responses to public events during the Bush administration. And so for the 4 years between the actual election and 2004, that's what I began to do. I didn't do it in a way that was forced. I had to actually feel moved to write. But if I felt moved to write, then I would write. And in order to extend the discourse of the piece, I brought in images to be in conversation, partly because there were things that I wanted recognized, but I didn't want to write about it. And the images helped me to open out the discussion in that way. And so it was a very organic unfolding.
You mentioned earlier in a talk that you put the images side by side with the text in Don't Let Me Be Lonely, such as Nelson Mandela wearing an HIV T-shirt without actually mentioning him in the text or mentioning his T-shirt in the text. And you mentioned that you wanted the image to corrupt the text, and I think corrupt is the word
exactly.
You use.
Or contaminate.
Contaminate.
And stain in some way, mm-hmm. so that the text and the image would start its own dialogue, and a dialogue that I had no control over, because what the reader took from the image would be what they take from the image. You know, you can't tell them what to take from the image. So it in that way, it was a sort of freeing up of the text by saying, look, there's this thing that I'm writing, and then there's this image that is in some vague way related to this text, but then go where you want in terms of how you integrate these two things. Because I didn't want the image to reiterate the text. It seemed to me if the image started to summarize the text or the text summarized the image, then one of them wasn't necessary.
Now, one other thing I want to leap to is the work that you're doing now is much more video-based work.
The video-based work, I'm writing scripts that we are trying to get in the backstory behind the image. And so I've been making films where we use an image, usually one available to the viewer. Then I write a script to it, and then we record it as a sort of sound over so that the writing and the image meet in conversation.
So, for example, you're using some video from Hurricane Katrina?
I'm using
the experience?
Exactly. Uh-huh. I've worked on a piece called Backed Up in the Soul, where I took text from CNN that addressed Hurricane Katrina, statements made by people either recording the events or people who were victim of the events. And I've put that together into a text, and that runs along with the video.
And in some way, structurally, it sounds a little bit like Don't Let Me Be Lonely, except in a different medium, with the text and the visual material running side by side or juxtaposed to each other?
Exactly. This time it's simultaneous,
okay,
as opposed to being almost pauses within the text itself. I've been working with my husband on this, and he's a filmmaker, and he's also very good in terms of being able to do things. So if I'm, for instance, doing a piece on 9/11, he can capture the 911 calls. And so the 911 calls will run simultaneously with my own voice reading as the image is being shown. So it'll have three layers of things happening at once.
Now, I understand you have some of the script for the Hurricane Katrina section.
I do.
Would you read a little bit of that?
Sure. The title, Backed Up in the Soul, came out of a poem by Cesar Vallejo called The Black Riders. I'm paraphrasing a little, but he says something like, there are blows in life so violent I can't answer. Blows as if from the hatred of God, as if the deep waters of everything lived through were backed up in the soul. So the backed up in the soul came from that. Hours later, still in the difficulty of what it is to be, just like that, just the way Stephen said, inside it, standing there, maybe waiting, maybe waving, standing where the deep waters of everything backed up, one said. Climbing over bodies, one said. Stranded on a roof, one said. Trapped in the building, and in the difficulty, nobody coming. And still someone saying, who could see it coming? The difficulty of that. The fiction of the facts assumes innocence, ignorance, lack of intention, misdirection, the necessary conditions of a certain time and place. Have you seen their faces? Fate, not fear, she said. I'd heard that once and was trying to stamp the phrase on my mind at the time. I couldn't speak it aloud. He wouldn't tolerate it. He was angry. Where were they? Where was anyone? This is a damn emergency, he said. So that's the opening section of that piece.
Yeah. Thank you. That's Claudia Rankin.
So I like the fact that I have no idea what a person would think when they saw the images that were included, but whatever they thought would have to be integrated into the text that they were reading.
Well, it's interesting. As I was reading Don't Let Me Be Lonely, I was reading it as if the form were the form of the essay. And I know it's called an American lyric, and I heard you refer to it as a book of poems. It's written in much in prose. And so I say that to give people a sense that it has all this visual artifacts from the culture, looks like prose. It's lyrical. Do you consider yourself part of a generation of writers that is identifiable as people who experiment with form?
More and more, I'm beginning to just consider myself a writer. And the way in which the form informs is important to me. And I think that the text generates its own form. But I identify with poetry and as a poet. And my world of references are poets. Vallejo, Salon, Neruda, Robert Haas, Louise Gluck. So when I pull a line out, it's often a line of poetry. It's from Stevens. It's from Eliot. And so because of that, because I come out of the economy of poetry, I feel that whatever I write is poetry. And even when it's the sentence that is the unit of consciousness, that's still, for me, a poem.
It reads like a poem. I wrote down a note as I was reading the book. I wanted to say to you, I think you've gone directly to the objective of literary writing, to write a book that is deeply interesting despite the expectations that received forms give us, because the forms are all up for other definitions, mm-hmm. and you're not too worried about defining the form in any traditional way.
Well, I think one of the liberating things about identifying as a poet is that there's nothing at stake for you. Mm-hmm. Because you're not going to make any money from it, really. So you can do whatever you want.
You can do whatever you want. I wonder if, before we leave, if you could read one more section from Don't Let Me Be
Sure.
Lonely.
I try to fit language into the shape of usefulness. The world moves through words as if the bodies the words reflect did not exist. The world, like a giant liver, receives everyone and everything, including these words. Is he dead? Is she dead? The words remain an inscription on the surface of my loneliness. This loneliness stems from a feeling of uselessness. Or Paul Celan said that the poem was no different from a handshake. I cannot see any basic difference between a handshake and a poem, is how Rosemary Waldrop translated his German. The handshake is our decided ritual of both asserting, I am here, and handing over, here, a self to another. Hence the poem is that, here, I am here. This conflation of the solidity of presence with the offering of this same presence perhaps has everything to do with being alive. Or one meaning of here is, in this world, in this life, on earth, in this place or position, indicating the presence of. Or in other words, I am here. It also means to hand something to somebody. Here you are. Here, he said to her. Here both recognizes and demands recognition. I see you, or here, he said to her. In order for something to be handed over, a hand must extend and a hand must receive. We must both be here, in this world, in this life, in this place, indicating the presence of.
Claudia Rankine. She talked about her book, Don't Let Me Be Lonely, with New Letters magazine editor Robert Stewart in 2008. This is just one in over 1,000 writers included in the New Letters on the Air archives. Many of our older shows are still on reel-to-reel tape. Finally, we have a chance to digitize them with a Save America's Treasures grant. But to get the full amount, we need to match the money by February 20th. You can help. Visit our website, newletters.org/radio, and click on Imperiled Voices, or call us toll-free 888-548-2477. I'm Angela Elam for New Letters on the Air.